listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last month, the Supreme Court held 3 days of hearings on the challenges to the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act passed by Congress in 2010. Jeffrey Toobin, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker and the senior legal analyst for CNN, joins us now to discuss the likely outcome of the case. Mr. Toobin has written extensively about the Supreme Court. His 2007 book, The Nine: Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, is available in paperback from Anchor. And his latest book, The Oath, The Obama White House versus the Supreme Court, will be published in September by Doubleday. And I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show.
Hi, Leonard.
Is the central question simply whether Congress has the power to impose an economic regulation on everyone?
Well, I like so many legal arguments, I think a lot of it depends on how you frame the question. I think that is how the Obama administration would like to frame the question, that this is simply another regulation like Medicare and Medicaid or, you know, any number of economic regulations in the healthcare field. The challengers to the law frame it as an unprecedented attempt by Congress to force individuals into a private market for a product that they may not choose to buy. That's how they frame the argument, and that's, you know, those sort of are the opposing views.
Donald Verrilli, the Solicitor General arguing for the Affordable Care Act in the Supreme Court, has been criticized for his performance. What did you think about it?
I thought it was lousy. I thought it was really a poor argument. I mean, I have to say,
do you think he damaged the case?
You know, I don't know. If you ask a Supreme Court justice, as I have over the years, you know, how often does the oral argument make a difference? And they say, well, a few times a year, maybe. And I think that is generally true in minor cases where they don't really have pre-existing views on the issue. This is anything but a minor case. These involve very profound issues about constitutional law that they have all thought about to a greater or lesser extent. So, no, I don't think Verrilli's performance will make that much of a difference in the votes. However, it's always better to do a good argument than a bad argument, and it was not a successful argument.
And he was also criticized for leaving out a wide range in coverage options that are available. The law doesn't require everyone to have the so-called Cadillac coverage.
No, he did. But, I mean, you know, one of the things that was so striking, I mean, look, Leonard, I have to say, I have been in a lot of Supreme Court arguments, and this was the most dramatic, the most exciting, the most just consequential moment. And I really include Bush v. Gore in that, where I was privileged to see both of those arguments as well. The thing that was so striking was, you know, many of us, the so-called experts on the Supreme Court, said, look, you know, this is not that big a deal. This case is – it's just obviously constitutional, and even the conservatives, except perhaps Thomas, would recognize that. Well, Verrilli got up there for the second day of arguments, the day they addressed the constitutionality of the mandate, the requirement to buy insurance. And
which is the crux of the argument.
Correct. That's the most controversial part. And he got up there and, you know, after about two sentences, the conservatives went after him with such concerted force, you know, the Chief Justice, Kennedy, Alito, Scalia, and you just sensed how controversial this law was to them and how it was quite possible it was going to lose. And I think Verrilli was very much thrown off his stride by the magnitude and the immediacy of the assault.
It has many provisions, including preventing insurers from refusing coverage for pre-existing conditions. Would it be unusual for the court to strike down the whole law rather than just focus on the individual mandate?
Well, there were 3 days of arguments. And the first day was about a procedural issue that didn't seem to trouble them at all, about whether they should decide the case now. And they seemed united in deciding the case now. Day two was about the mandate. Day three was the question that you're asking right now, which is, excuse me, if the mandate is declared unconstitutional, how much, if any, of the rest of the law goes with it? And I was shocked to see that several justices were very much entertaining the idea that you just take the whole law out, even though they acknowledged that much of the law is uncontroversial from a constitutional point of view. I mean, like the pre-existing condition, like keeping kids staying on their parents' insurance till the age 26. And Kennedy in particular, Anthony Kennedy, often described as the swing justice, seemed in many respects the most enthusiastic about getting rid of the whole law. So, again, there I was less convinced about the ultimate outcome than I was about the mandate. But clearly, certainly Scalia was very much advocating for throwing the whole law out.
Were you surprised when he complained about having to read all 2,700 pages of the law? Don't most of the justices have their law clerks do that for
them?
Yeah,
I mean, you know, I don't think any members of Congress read the 2,700 pages either, and I doubt President Obama did either. A lot of law is boilerplate. And the thing that was so striking about Scalia's arguments was that they were very much pitched at a sort of soundbite level. He talked about things like, you know, the Cornhusker kickback, which was an attempt to get Ben Nelson's vote, the senator from Nebraska, that was very controversial. It wound up not even being in the bill. So I mean, it was really completely irrelevant. I mean, he talked about, you know, what about a requirement to have people eat broccoli?
So he was thinking a lot about vegetables.
He was thinking a lot about vegetables and a lot about sort of ridiculing the law rather than addressing it.
But he was ridiculed for making that broccoli comparison because it just seemed so ridiculous.
I don't know. I mean, he might have been ridiculed by liberals who like the law, but I think that argument, that, you know, the sort of the nanny state argument that the government can tell you to do anything, including whether to eat broccoli, has been at least a serious argument in the conservative media. So, you know, maybe he was ridiculed in some circles, but not all.
Now, if the court decided to find the law unconstitutional, would it go back to Congress for revision? Or would
That would be the end of it. The Congress could choose to go back and try to revive some of it. But, I mean, think about the politics of that. Even when there were 60 Democratic senators, Obama got it through barely, and a substantial Democratic majority in the House. That House majority is completely gone. The Senate majority is down to 53. There is no way in the world this law is going to be revived in any form if it goes back to Congress.
Mike, although Congress may change its complexion again with the next election,
who knows? It will, but, you know, healthcare tends to be a sort of once-a-generation effort, and we've had our once-a-generation.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin of CNN and The New Yorker. We're talking about the Supreme Court and healthcare. Hasn't the idea of the individual mandate been around for a while? It came from the Heritage Foundation. So this was actually a creation of a very conservative group. What made it attractive for conservatives at that time, and why is it so unattractive now?
Well, it's remained. It started out as a conservative idea because, as opposed to, say, a single-payer system like you have in Canada or much of Europe, a mandate involves the private sector centrally. And it basically continues the model that most Americans are familiar of, is that most of us get our insurance through insurance companies. It simply creates a market where everybody is in the market. I mean, the most obvious comparison is auto insurance. I mean, every state has a requirement that you have to buy auto insurance, and this would simply extend it to medical insurance.
And I'm assuming President Obama thought, well, this is what's going to get bipartisan support for this law.
Well, yeah, so much for that. I mean, it didn't get bipartisan support, but it
didn't even get the support of some Democrats.
It barely got the support of enough Democrats to be passed. But it was certainly perceived at the time as a more conservative alternative to the single-payer program that had been a liberal dream for many years. I mean, after all, we do have Medicare for older Americans, which is essentially a single-payer program, and that, you know, one idea was simply to extend Medicare to everyone. That was rejected early on in the process.
A caller has asked, how is the individual mandate for health insurance different from mandates for auto insurance?
Well, that's a great question that frequently gets asked, and there's a simple answer. But it's the answer is auto insurance is regulated entirely by the states. The states have what's called general police powers over their states. So they don't have restrictions on the kinds of laws they can pass. They can pass laws on anything. The federal government is restricted by the Constitution, which limits the power of the federal government. One of the powers described in Article 1 of the Constitution is the power to regulate interstate commerce.
The Commerce Clause.
The Commerce Clause. That is the power under which Congress does a lot of its economic regulations, but it is a limited power. And so states can do auto insurance without any constitutional concern, and states like Massachusetts can do health care reform in a very similar way to the Obama plan. There's no constitutional issue there, but the Commerce Clause is the restriction in the federal system.
But many people said that there is already a precedent for this sort of thing, a rather obscure case until it made the newspapers recently, Wickard versus Filburn.
Ah, Wickard versus Filburn. It's one of the great cases we all study in law school.
So it's not that obscure.
It's not that obscure, but I mean, you know, only law students read it. It's not a case that, you know, has much relevance to people's lives, and it actually relates to one of the great historical controversies in the Supreme Court, which was in the 1930s when President Roosevelt started the New Deal. The court rejected a lot of his major plans, the National Recovery Administration, This led Roosevelt to propose his infamous court packing plan in 1937, where he was going to add a number of justices. And this was stymied in Congress. But because of the change in one justice, Owen Roberts, the so-called switch in time that saved the nine, they started approving economic regulations. And in 1942, Wickard v. Philbin, they allowed regulation of the wheat market and basically said Congress has free rein to regulate in the economic sphere.
You've also written about Schechter Poultry Corp.
The
versus
sick chicken
United
case,
States.
As it's known, yes.
How is that relevant?
Well,
here?
That was the Schechter Poultry, which was actually a kosher butcher in Brooklyn, was regulated under the National Recovery Act. And they challenged the NRA, and in 1935, the Supreme Court declared the NRA unconstitutional, and it was the height of the Supreme Court's conflict with President Roosevelt. The Schechter Poultry was the case that was reversed in the case you mentioned earlier, Wickard v. Filburn, and it basically was the high point of Commerce Clause as being a restriction on the federal government.
And it's interesting that FDR talked about stacking the Supreme Court. I've been receiving emails from conservative groups claiming that President Obama is now has a plan, a secret plan to stack the Supreme Court today.
Well, he would love to do that, but it ain't happening.
Well, I mean, but more and more crazy stuff is coming in. Alan Keyes, the congressman from Florida, announced yesterday that there
no,
were...
No, wait, that's not Alan Keyes. Alan West.
I'm sorry.
Alan Keyes was the guy who ran against Obama for the Senate.
I'm sorry, Alan West. He declared that there are 80 Democrats in Congress who are card-carrying communists.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I haven't heard something like that since
it's very 1950s, yeah.
What about the Commerce Clause and the Civil Rights Act of 1964? Wasn't it applied there?
One of the challenges to the Civil Rights Act was you can't tell some hotel in Georgia that it has to admit black people. That has nothing to do with interstate commerce. You know, it's a hotel in the middle of the state. What does that have to do with interstate commerce? And what the Supreme Court said in a wonderfully named opinion called the Heart of Atlanta Motel said, no, we are not going to tell Congress how to regulate the national economy. The Congress has decided that racism, discrimination, affects commerce when all of the transactions are collectively considered. And we are not going to disturb that conclusion. And that was just, you know, that reflected the court's attitude, which was, look, the economy is Congress's business. We are not going to get involved. That's why the possibility of striking down healthcare is such a dramatic departure from traditional jurisprudence.
And I assume that if the Warren Court were hearing this case, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
We would not be having it, pleasant though it is.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the senior legal analyst for CNN. His book from 2007, The Nine Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, is now available in paperback from Anchor. And you have a new book coming out which deals very specifically with this current situation.
Well,
are you still working on it?
Well, yes. I mean, in fact, the book is mostly written, but the big finish is not written yet because it will obviously end with the healthcare case. So I'm going to have to write that quickly.
The Oath, the Obama White House versus the Supreme Court, which will be published in September, you hope, by Doubleday. We'll continue our conversation.
I certainly hope so.
We'll continue this conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later on in the show, New York Council Speaker Christine Quinn retraces the story of her grandmother, who was a Titanic survivor. Burmese opposition leader and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi recently won a seat in Myanmar's parliament. Last month, I spoke with actress Michelle Yeoh and director Luc Besson about Aung San Suu Kyi and their film, The Lady, which opens today. You can hear that interview on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast, and you can find me on Facebook and Twitter.